welcome to an Inside Power Talking podcast, our latest and greatest effort, recorded Wednesday, March 7th, 2007. Thanks for joining us. My name is Joe Gladyszewski. I cover the ECAC Hockey League and host the podcast, joined by Inch editor and columnist Mike Eidelbus and senior writer covering Hockey East, Jeff Howe. The theme, I think, that has been running through my mind is, are we there yet? And the answer is yes. This is the postseason. We're ready to go with exciting playoff action when teams are playing for their lives or playing for a chance to play again. I guess we'll start with recapping the regular season and a topic that comes up when awards are handed out. Many of the leagues are starting to award their all-conference teams, and that's what kind of criteria people use when they make these votes. And it's something the Inch writers have to do also this week, as we will unveil our season recaps in this week's notebooks. What's more important, Bus, winning or outstanding individual performance, regardless of where you finish in the standings?
That's a very good question, and I have always I've tended to place an emphasis on winning in the past. That said, I guess I have to be taken to task for voting for Matt Carl for Hobie last year. I think one thing that gets I think a lot of voters, whether it's All-Conference or All-America, fall into a trap of kind of going back to statistics and using that as the primary factor in coming to their decision or coming to their or making their minds up regarding a player's relative worth. And I think a case in point or a very good example of this is Mike Santarelli from Northern Michigan. Certainly a great player, nearing the 30 goal mark. He's among the nation's leaders in that category, but Northern Michigan is a disappointing team in my opinion. In the CCHA, they finished 10th in the league, and yet he was voted to the CCHA first team. Whereas nobody from Notre Dame, other than goaltender David Brown, made the first or second team. So to me, that says that the coaches in the CCHA, sure, he did have an outstanding individual season, but I think that when you're rewarding players in this manner, I think you got to look beyond just the individual effort and find out and consider what they bring to a team in terms of not in a forward's case or a defenseman's case, not just statistics, but how their play affects the team, their leadership. The intangibles that they bring, those kind of things, which I think tend to get lost.
Jeff, you had some tough calls to make in selecting your All-Hockey East team. What did you lean towards?
I mean, you've got to go towards the players who are on the teams that win, I think, first and foremost. I know there were some tough choices of defense that I really had, and one of the guys I looked at was, Louis Liotti at Northeastern. Just I love the way he plays. He's got a great plus minus, and he's a real physical guy, good defender. But he's also on Northeastern. I mean, I left him off because, as a group, Boston University plays amazing defense, and I tried really hard to only keep it to one blue liner from the Terriers, but especially when I had Curry backstopping my first team. But when all was said and done, I had to go with two guys, and there were really three guys. Schaefer was every bit as deserving as the first two guys that I went with. So it's tough. You try to spread stuff like that out among a few different teams, but every now and then you've just got a team that does something so well that it's hard to ignore. And then among the forwards with Trevor Smith and Nathan Gerby, who were pretty much locks on the forward line. And then it comes down to guys like Lovelier and Purcell and Boyle, and there's six guys on UNH who you could go with. There are a few more on BU who you could go with. So you know, finding one forward to finding three forwards, I guess, when you've got probably 15 to 18 of them who have, you know, who probably deserve a spot on the first team, it can be kind of difficult.
You know, I'm glad.
Go ahead.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm glad you brought up Nate Gerby because, first of all, he's a favorite of mine, going back to when he was with the under 18 team, and I think he's kind of the poster child for this argument. Yeah, he's had a good year, but still, you look at his statistics. He's third on the team in scoring, if I remember correctly, behind Ferriot and Boyle. But yet, every time he's on the ice, something happens, and that doesn't show up in the statistics. And, you know, I think you can really make a strong case for Gerby for the Hockey East Player of the Year just because he is so important to what Boston College does. And if the team's in a lull, he can go out there and provide a spark and make something happen. Again, it doesn't necessarily lead to it doesn't necessarily directly lead to a goal or to him putting some points on the board. But if it's just with his demeanor or kind of his tenacity or the edge and the grit that he plays with, which is truly remarkable for a guy his size. You know, I think for what he brings to that team and the kind of role he fills and the spark that he provides, you can't measure how valuable he is to what Boston College does.
Yeah, and his value is exactly why he belonged on the team. Like you said, I mean, he's not even the high scorer on the team. He's, you know, like top 10 in the league. So, you know, if you wanted to go simply out of point production, you go with Brian Boyle, who led the league with 42 points this year. But Gerby was so valuable for BC's turnaround down the stretch. It was like once he started playing well, that whole first line of he, Brock Bradford, and, you know, Boyle started playing well. And then that took a little more pressure off the second line with Ferriot and I think Rooney. And, you know, I'm trying to think of, you know, that line. So all of a sudden, you've got one line that is continually setting the pace, the second line, which is picking up some slack, and then lately, over the last 2 or 3 weeks, their third line has been scoring every, you know, here and there, and when they're not scoring, they're playing well. So all of a sudden, you've got BC, which is, you know, struggling to, you know, get some consistency out of all three, you know, in the forwards and the defensemen. All of a sudden, you've got three great lines, or two great lines, and one really good line going into the playoffs. And you've also got the hottest team in the nation. You know, it's not a coincidence. So, and Gerby's play, you could argue, is the sole reason for that whole trickle-down effect on Boston College right now.
He's been their best player all year, no question. From day one to where we are now, and you know, he's been their best player.
He has, and I mean, he struggled here at times in the first half of the season, but, you know, I think that had a lot to do with their line, and, you know, there were some injuries, and, you know, some things went on, but the second half of the season, I mean, he's been lights out. He's been the best player in the league over the second half, but, you know, the player of the year, I think, still has to go to John Curry because of what he did for the team throughout the course of the season. But, I mean, if you're looking at the second-half player of the year, I think it's Nate Gerby without a question.
But
you guys made a point that I was going to make. One of the criteria that people have to look at when deciding these is the wow factor. Who do you pay your $20 to go and see at the rink? Who you notice out there on a shift-to-shift basis? You got to watch the games. You can't just look at the box scores and say, oh, this guy's got the most points. He must be great. And
right.
Another factor that wasn't looked at, I don't think CCHA coaches and writers use this criteria very much. Nathan Davis was a second team selection. He's a guy that we had touted all season long because of his contributions to Miami. I think the choice probably would have been Davis, Hensick, and Parse if I had to go with the first team instead of Santarelli, who we mentioned. And another guy who didn't even make honorable mention was Brian Lurg of Michigan State, whose factor for the Spartans was the timing of his goals.
Yep.
And He's got 8 game-winning goals, 21 goals in the season. You know, there's a guy who, if you watch a Michigan State game, you know that he's one of their best players. You know what he means to that team, and you know that he comes through when it matters. And there are other stats regarding his plus-minus in the third period. You know, it was highly was very high compared to other forwards in the league, and his clutchness is not something that you can see in the Sunday paper. But if you watch these guys play and you know what they mean to a team, I think there's room for that, and that there's room for that criteria.
Oh, definitely. And I, you know, once again, you go back to kind of I don't mean to set up Brian Boyle as the antithesis of what we're trying to get at here, but you look at Gerby and Jeff, as you said, you know, there was a point in the season early on where he was struggling, but still he did things that helped the team. Whereas Boyle, when things don't go right for him, he kind of goes into the tank a little bit. I mean, there's two different ways that you can deal with things as a player. You can either, you know, continue to do other things to help the team, whether that's killing penalties or playing responsible defense or blocking shots or finishing checks, you know, or just working hard for 35, 45 seconds at a time, as opposed to when things aren't going your way offensively, to sulk and take shifts off and just disappear. And, you know, I think that has to be part of the consideration as well, in that, you know, points don't tell the whole story. But, you know, you're talking about coaches who get to see players maybe once or twice a year, how closely... You know, it's kind of the same argument that people make about the coaches poll in college football. How much do these coaches actually see these other teams?
Yeah, but I think that they see as much or more than most writers.
No, I think you're
writers that are on a specific beat because they watch the video and they make game plans to stop the best players on the other teams. And when I make my selections, whether it's a Hobie Tracker type of a thing or in this case, this season, a Hobie Baker vote, or naming my all ECAC Hockey League team, I flat out ask the coaches.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if I'm stuck between two guys or three guys, I ask them what they think. You know, they're the ones who know. And people, you know, are quick to judge, you know, and say, oh, Inch doesn't know what they're talking about, or another website doesn't know what they're talking about. At least in my case, you know, I'm presenting information. You know, it's not an opinion. It's a researched publication. You know, I ask people. And there was a guy who will be unveiled in this week's ECAC Hockey League notebook that I chose, and I was probably not going to choose him for my all-league team, but I was convinced by three coaches in the league that he was the right choice.
Well, no, you're – oh, okay. I was going to say you teased it, but I think I know to whom you're referring, so – I won't.
It's Reed Cashman.
Oh, I was trying to build up some suspense.
Well, I have no secrets.
Okay.
And by the time most people listen to this, they will have read the ECAC Hockey League notebook.
Oh, all right.
Because everybody reads that one.
Oh, yeah, it's the first one.
All the folks in Thief River Falls, the ECAC fans out there.
I print it out and have it laminated.
I've seen your lamination display.
And then I put it in a three-ring binder, and I save them. I like to refer back to them.
The Noah Welch Fan Club edition?
I footnote them, actually. I highlight the names.
Yeah.
They're all indexed. But, you know, that's another good point, is not only talking with the coaches, and if you talk to enough coaches about players, opposing coaches, you know, you get to hear the same names over and over again. And if you talk to opposing players, you know, their opinions are at times overlooked, but I mean, those guys know who's out there, you know, playing hard and who means a lot to their team, or you know, who's tough to go up against and who's overrated and that type of thing.
Now, almost every time I had a player either after a game or on the phone and had a couple of minutes, you know, I turned the recorder off and just chatted. Who are the hard teams to play against? Who are the difficult players to play against? Who do you like playing against? You know, there's some guys that really like to test themselves against the best, and
mm-hmm.
you get great matchups, you know. And one of those, not this past season or this current season, I should say, but last year, two sophomore centermen in Tyler Burton and Nick Dodge, they just loved going head-to-head against each other. And that makes great players better, and they know when they're challenged and when they're tested. So,
you know, this is a few years ago, and I don't know that they've done it since, because I haven't seen a WCHA Final Five game program. But a while back, they did a survey of captains. And, you know, they asked them some general questions about, you know, kind of the softball stuff, like what's your favorite TV show, what's your favorite food, why do you like, you know, going to school X. But they asked them, you know, which goalie do you like to face, or which goalie is the toughest, you know, to go up against, and which player is the toughest for you to play against. And the answers were interesting, and, you know, it's not always the top player from the top team that gets answered.
Right.
You get to see, you know, a lot of one-on-one battles unfold as you get to follow a certain team throughout the course of the season. I mean, my favorite, you know, one-on-one matchup to watch this year has been Eric Riva, the big defenseman from BU, go against Nathan Gerby. I mean, it's like every single game. There were a couple different times when I thought these two guys were going to get thrown out for everything that they did after the whistle. I mean, there was one game I saw when Gerby took Grava's stick and threw it across the ice. It was just, I mean, those two playing against each other, it's hilarious to watch. You love seeing those two guys on the ice at the same time. And I guarantee there are a lot of college hockey fans who have no idea who Eric Grava is. I mean, he's been a solid defenseman for BU, an up-and-coming kid, but, I mean, the real reason I even noticed him is because of the stuff that goes on between he and Gerby, you know, before the whistle and mostly after the whistle.
Yeah, those are fun. That's when hockey really does get fun.
And you know that those two guys, regardless of all the junk that goes on, you know that when BC and BU play, you know they both look forward to it because they know they're in for a battle.
Absolutely.
I mean, you know it's the highlight of their season, knowing that they get to go up against these guys.
And you can expect that, you know, when that handshake comes at the end of their careers or at the end of their seasons, you know, it's not just going to be a, hey, man, what's up? It's a genuine handshake, probably a hug, and, you know, thanks for making me a better player.
Mm-hmm.
And that emotion, and you see that in a lot of the great postseason hockey tradition of the handshake line, that those battles between a lot of guys, it's a special thing when you go up against them, and especially as frequently as Boston University and Boston College play against one another.
Exactly.
Stats interpretation. This happened in a game I was at on Saturday. I don't know the answer, but it's worth discussing. Let me give you a play-by-play, and you guys can weigh in. Player on the visiting team, and I think that's an important part of this, but in the visiting team takes a shot on goal and it hits the goalie's stick, the back part of the stick, above the blade, the paddle, I guess we'll call it. And the shot, it was a hard shot, and it knocked the stick out of the goalie's hand. So his stick goes to the end boards, the rebound comes out to the other side wing, and the goalie comes post to post now to make this save with no stick and kind of goes butterfly and gets it with his pad to make the stop. And the puck kicks out to the circle, you know, out to the half wall, where player on the goalie's team picks it up, rushes 160 feet, beats a defenseman, and scores. Assist to the goalie, yes or no?
No.
Rook says no.
I've been thinking about this for a little bit because we talked about this before.
I have the NCAA statistics manual. I just don't have
it. Off the top of my head, I would... I think theoretically no, but realistically I can see where he might get one.
So are you being theoretical or realistic?
I would, if I'm going by the letter of the law, I think that I would say no. If I was put in that position as an official scorer with no, and this is an important condition, with no allegiance to either team.
Affiliation.
Yeah. I would say no assist. To me, an assist is something that leads directly to a scoring play.
And a goalie kneeling down without a stick and getting in the way of a shot does not lead to a scoring play.
No, not directly. I think obviously indirectly it does, but...
Yes.
But we know how... You know, we know how those things can be home cooked.
They can be. And that's not an accusation I'm making. It's
No.
And it was, for the people, it was, the goalie was credited with an assist on that play, which helped tons of people in their ECAC Hockey Fantasy League playoff pool.
Playoff edition.
Well, I was playing against the team that had that goalie, so I got eliminated early.
Dug yourself a hole.
Yeah.
Yep.
You took too many guys who had the bye weeks.
What does the rule book say?
I don't know. I'll look it up, and we'll talk about it on the Next Inch podcast.
I thought you did. I thought you said you did look it up.
No, I said, thanks for listening. I said, I don't have the stats manual with me now.
Oh, I thought you said you did.
But I do own
Thanks
it.
For listening. What are you, my wife?
Not yet.
Oh, man.
Keep up these long late night conversations.
Oh, man.
I'll look it up. We'll mention it on the Next Inch podcast.
If I don't think I even have an NCAA rule book here. I should have.
I have the stats manual.
I've got the NHL one, which really does us no good.
I don't think it would be in the rule book, anyway. Stats manual.
Ah, you're right. It might not be in the rule book.
If people are listening and they have an interpretation or citation of the specific scoring language, feel free to send it along to inch@insidecollegehockey.com. That's our email address.
You know, it brings up a good point, though, about interpretation.
If you're scoring at home, or if you're by
or
yourself.
Even if you're by yourself. it brings up an interesting point, though, about statistical interpretation. And one of the things that I always found funny is shots on goal, like what constitutes a shot on goal. And it seems like it should be fairly cut and dried. But, you know, some people have, you know, try to interpret intent as part of a shot on goal. Like if a guy dumps one in from 150 feet away and it comes, you know, it goes...
The goalie comes out.
The goalie has to stop it. You know, it comes right through the crease and the goalie plays it. And the shot chart person says, well, that wasn't a shot because he was just dumping it and that wasn't his intent. Well, you know, if it goes through the goalie's legs and it goes in the net... Does it not count because that wasn't the guy's intent?
It?
He didn't intend to score?
My bad, guys.
Yeah.
Just face it off the center.
Yeah. So, you know, there are a lot of... You can write rule books and, you know, statistical guides and that type of thing, but a lot of it just... I think hockey's like baseball in that way where there's a lot of room for interpretation.
I just
interpretation.
Add something to that. I mean, when I'm not burying myself in Hockey East books and, you know, doing 12-hour workdays for Inch and, you know, watching games
tape.
At night.
Watching
tape. Yeah, exactly. You know, hanging out in the coaches' rooms, breaking down the films. I work at it.
You Ron Jaworski.
Exactly. Dissecting, you know, neutral zone traps. I work at another place, and I've covered some high school games, and I've sat next to, you know, writers who, you know, I'm not going to judge their hockey knowledge, but I mean,
but I am.
but I often wonder, you know, if somebody reads my game story and then reads their game story in their newspaper, you know, one after another, they're going to read my story and see goalie A had 27 saves, and they're going to read this person's game story and read goalie A had 78 saves because this kid decided to call it a save because a goalie covered up the puck. And, you know, I've seen that I don't even know how many times. And I just, it pains me to watch people do things like that. And I often wonder, you know, if these people ever went on to be stat keepers. I mean, there would be no need for things such as steroids in baseball.
That hit the wall. It's a home run.
It was intended to be a home run.
He took a home run swing.
He did,
and
he hit it over the backstop. That's a fence.
Yeah, it's like when you're 8 years old and you're playing wiffle ball, the Chinese home run, because you hit it out of the park foul.
What?
Kind of home run?
I believe they like to be called Asian
American home run. Look. I've never heard that.
Oh,
well, I guess I grew up in a strange neighborhood.
Yeah, I guess so. He grew up in that subdivision called.
Can you say those things on podcast?
Let's not get into that again.
Podcast deterioration is sneaking in. Sneaking in a little early.
I've never heard of the Chinese home run.
Yeah, I never heard of that one.
Maybe that was
regional dialect.
Sadahara O or something. Oh, he was Japanese. Is there only one Japanese slugger?
That is true. I think the I read a story about steroid use in baseball today. Speaking of stats. And I believe the player's name is David Bell. And if it's not, I apologize.
No, it is.
It is, okay. He was quoted as saying, "Yes, I did receive a prescription for HGH, but it was for a medical ailment that I will not disclose." And my first thought was that the medical ailment was warning track power.
Exactly. Yeah, I got this disease called I'm hitting 210. Can you do something about it?
Yeah, I've got this disease called my name is David Bell and nobody knows who I am.
I'm a third baseman and I hit 5 home runs a year.
You guys know my friend Brady Anderson?
Yeah.
So.
Exactly.
Yeah, that was that.
Were you surprised?
Plus, you want to talk about TJ Hensick being awesome at hockey?
I do.
Let's talk about that. We mentioned it in this week's Hobie Trackler.
This is the Trackler, yes. Trackler. And this is a nice segue from HGH, because as we all know, I'm just kidding. He actually shot the puck through a goalie this year. We were putting together the Trackler last night, or Tuesday night, I should say. And just kind of went back and looked at his consistency over his career. And I think he was something like, if he didn't have 4 seasons of 50-plus points, he was very close. And it just got me to thinking, are we in an era now with the NHL teams being more prepared and more willing to go to draft college-bound players or players in college, and also willing to bring those guys in,
sign them,
and sign them and develop them in the minor leagues and you know, or in a few cases, get him right into the pros, into the lineup. Hentschel's got 209 career points, and I'm just wondering if he's the last one we're going to see of this nature for a while. Scott Parse is close. He's got 197 with a minimum of two games remaining in his Nebraska-Omaha career. But is this? I'm just wondering if this is an end of an era. I got to a certain extent, I want to say yes, because I got a feeling that when guys who this talented, guys who have the possibility to put up these kind of points come through the system, they're not going to be staying 4 years. They're going to be out 2-3 years or one.
Yeah.
I mean, is this an end of it? Is this the end of an era?
Yeah. Hentschel's totals, 46 as a freshman, then 55, 52, and 56 points this year for his 209-point total, which is really quite remarkable. In Hockey East right now,
42
points leads overall. This is overall scoring. Brian Boyle leads at 42 in the WCHA. Total points 49 for Ryan Duncan, 43 for Mason Raymond. Nodal, 42. Maybe he's a guy, undrafted.
Well, and I think Duncan can be a guy, too. He's got, what did you say, 49 this year?
49.
I think he had 30-something last year. I want to say 36 or in that neighborhood last year. And he is, he'd have to crank it up. But, again, he's an undrafted kid. So, and he's not the biggest kid in the world either. I think he's listed at 5'7 or 5'8 or something in that neighborhood. So, you know, although size isn't as big of an issue in the NHL as it was in years past, pre-lockout, you know, is a team willing to take a risk on or willing to throw some money at it at signing him as a free agent? I mean, he might be the poster boy or the guy the type of guy who will, you know, be able to put up 200 career points.
Yeah. And when we were talking about this before the podcast began recording, I mentioned Reed Cashman.
Mm-hmm.
And who's just put up buckets of points, and he's only around 140 for his career. So you've got that. That shows how impressive a milestone it really is for these guys to end their careers that way.
Well, you know, and another. Go ahead.
Go ahead.
No, you go ahead.
What? No, you go. I think if you come out and you're a freshman, and you know, obviously to score 200 points, you're going to have to average 50 over the course of your career. I mean, as a freshman,
good job.
I know. Well, I mean, I have a Lowell High School education, so you got to figure the learning starts as a freshman. That's probably going to be your statistical down year. And you know, if you have 40 points, you know, as a freshman, you're going to turn a lot of heads and. You know, out of NHL scouts. So they're going to start putting a little more heat on you as you start to grow older. So, you know, in order to even start reaching that statistical, you know, mark, I mean, you have to stay on average with it. I mean, you have to put up huge years. And if you can do it while you're younger, scouts and, you know, NHL organizations are going to try to take you out of college and, you know, feed you a little money and say that, you know, the life is greener and in the American League than it is in, you know, Hockey East and stuff like that. So money certainly can talk to these kids. So that's a huge factor nowadays.
Yeah, that all those reasons are why we probably won't see it, Boston. That was a good, definitely a good pickup by you.
And I think that you're kind of looking, you know, you're looking at a lot of things have to come together for a kid to score 200 points. I mean, obviously he's got to be there for 4 years. Obviously he's got to play with good teammates. I mean, Hentschel's been surrounded by Camilleri and Kevin Porter and Cogliano and guys like that, Jack Johnson, for 4 years. I mean, you got to have those kind of players around you. I think, you know, given the state of the NHL and with the salary cap and typically college guys can be a cheaper alternative than some other options out there, especially when you come in under those real strict entry-level contract guidelines, you're not going to see the guys, the real high-end guys, stay for 4 years any longer, or it's going to be the exception rather than the rule. So you're going to have a guy like Duncan who maybe slips through the cracks because he's, you know, not big, or, you know, thinking of the kid from Western Michigan, Mark Letetsu, who's, I think he's a 23-year-old freshman or a 22-year-old freshman. He scored 46 points this year for Western Michigan. You know, those kind of players, I think, are going to be the guys who are going to have a chance. And but I think that it's I think it's going to be a dying breed, the 200-point scorer.
And it's harder to get points now than it was 15, 20 years ago.
A lot harder.
Yeah, I mean, this got to be a pretty big topic around Beanpot time in Hockey East, because somebody on the Globe picked up about it and, you know, wrote a big feature.
The best writer in the United States picked up on it.
So, you know, coaches...
giggles it off. Jim McCabe. Jim McCabe.
You were a big Jim McCabe guy.
Huge Jim McCabe
That's
guy.
Just because he gets to go to the Masters every year.
Yeah, I get to go to the Frozen every year, so there. In your face, Jim McCabe.
Same weekend.
Yep.
I know. You got to make choices in life.
You know what?
A huge breakdown of it. And, you know, coaches started saying over the, you know, following, you know, week or two, it was like every time you cover a game in which a team won 2-1 or 3-2, a coach would just start all this. They obviously read McCabe's piece, and they would just, you know, without anybody even questioning them, they'd be like, well, you know, defenses are obviously better nowadays, and you've got a lot of guys, you know, like Jerry York and Jack Parker were saying that they're focusing a whole lot more of their attention now on teaching defense to these kids. And it also helps the fact that Hockey East has a group of tremendously talented goalies, but, you know, the technology on their equipment has gotten a whole lot more advanced over the last couple of years. You know, they're wearing lighter pads, and, you know, they're wearing masks that give them better, you know, peripheral vision. And, you know, everything's lighter. It's like, you know, they're not even wearing pads out there. It's just the game has been geared towards defense so much so over the last few years. And, you know, now the technology of it and, you know, so on. I mean, there are a number of different reasons why we may never see that breed of 200-point scores, you know, from here on out.
And I'd like to thank Jim McCabe for being the greatest sports writer in America.
He's the greatest?
I think so.
Oh, all right.
I used to have him as the best golf writer in America, which he is by far. But I think overall, he's the guy. He gets it.
Wow. And he gets to go to all the big tournaments.
Well, yeah, I mean, what? I guess it's like comparing Tiger Woods and, you know, who's good in basketball? Shaquille O'Neal.
Who's good in basketball? How about LeBron James?
LeBron James. All right. Here you go. I don't watch this silly game. You know, you got to compare them relative to their field. And what
right.
Jim McCabe does in golf writing is superior to what everybody else does in everybody else's writing. Peter
James
King is close.
So
Peter
it would be
King
like, okay, I get it. I get it.
You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, he's so far above. It would be like Roger Federer in tennis.
Gotcha, yeah.
Versus...
Yeah, Federer versus LeBron. It's hard. You can't really compare them, you know.
But Federer is far better in his field than LeBron is in his.
Yeah, Federer and Tiger, you know, are in the conversation.
Yes.
And Big Poppy. And not Tom Brady.
Oh.
All right.
Hey, we'll see. I know the future of the Patriots is set when they draft Tom Brady Jr. in the year 2029.
Oh no, Tom Brady. He's gonna be a hyphen. He's gonna be Brady Moynihan.
I think they have lawsuits for that sort of thing.
How are they gonna get
Who's
that?
Who's your daddy?
Yeah.
Pedro came in and said, "The Yankees are my daddy." And then this guy said, "No, Tom Brady's my daddy." I think.
Since we're on the subject, I will bring up the greatest night of my life when I was at Yankee Stadium for Game 7 in 2004 when the Red Sox came back from the greatest deficit in sports history to knock the Pinstripers out of the ALCS before they won a certain World Series. But the reason I'm talking about it is because that was the season of the "Who's Your Daddy" chant, and when Pedro came in and I think it was the seventh inning, it might have been the eighth, but I think it was the seventh, and he got roughed up a little bit, let up a couple runs. The entire stadium was chanting, "Who's your daddy?" And, it helped that the Sox were winning 10-3 at the time. So, it wasn't too bad, but that was one of the coolest things that I've ever witnessed in a sporting event because, 55,000 people cheering the same exact thing for, 10 straight minutes while Pedro's on the mound, and it gives you the goosebumps. Then the Red Sox won the World Series a week later.
That is true.
That was I think that was just a dream.
That was 04, man? Wow.
04.
Yeah,
time goes by quickly. This season has gone by quickly.
This season did go by quickly. The whole Red Sox thing was tainted when Jimmy Fallon was on the field celebrating with the team.
Anything Jimmy Fallon does is, a taint. Jimmy Fallon, that whole movie tainted one of the greatest sports books ever written. Fever Pitch.
I did not see the movie. I refused.
I haven't either, and I refuse.
Honestly, if I would have been a Red Sox running on the field and I see Jimmy Fallon, I would have punched him right in the face.
Like Rick Vaughn and Roger Dorn?
Yeah, exactly. I would have gotten Roger Dorn on his pie hole.
And then helped him up?
No, I would have kicked him.
You wouldn't have helped him.
Kicked him in the groin.
And
then taken his wallet.
Who's got a wallet on a baseball ring?
Jimmy Fallon.
I guess.
Actually, I would have had that little friend of Pedro Martinez step on him, too.
He recently died.
I know. I saw that. He passed away. What was his name?
I can't remember.
Pedro's Wingman?
Yeah.
Something like that.
Remember that little guy?
Yeah.
He looked like Otis Nixon.
What a little. QM needs to listen to this podcast.
Why, is he an Otis Nixon fan?
We've touched on many of his favorite subjects. Pedro's little friend.
That's right. He does like that guy. The only thing we haven't talked about is that Burger King commercial.
Steroids.
And Mike Piazza.
QM's all about steroids.
Well, you can
special
tell.
Recognition to QM. Everybody,
that's a shout-out.
Oh, any other podcast shout-outs?
He's a friend.
Any podcast shout-outs?
A friend of Inch.
Yes, he is.
I do, but I'll save it for the end because it's kind of a downer.
Oh, God.
Okay. Boss, you got a podcast shout-out?
No. Nobody.
Anybody listening?
Like Harry Doyle says, nobody's listening anyway.
Nobody's listening anyway.
You can't say that. I'm going to have to get that clip for next week.
We did that clip last week.
I know. You can't say that.
You can't say that on the air. Doesn't matter.
No shout-outs. This is actually the East-only podcast. Is that correct?
It's mostly Eastern-based.
We've
discussed Ryan Duncan. He's Western.
Chinese home run in Southwest.
No, that's Far East.
Far East again. Chinese home run.
I thought that was something from the Little League World Series, because didn't China win 50 years in a row with all those 20-year-old
Taipei.
Chinese Taipei, yes.
Yeah.
Chan Ho Park.
That never gets old.
Chan Ho Park. Does Hideo Nomo still pitch?
Is he left-handed? Then the answer is yes.
No, but he's a righty. Was Hideki a rep? Was he righty? Was he a lefty?
He ate with both hands. That's for sure.
Yeah.
Got to share a quick quote. Seth Appert, coach of the Rensselaer Engineers, wrapped up his first season in charge of the team and said, "We're an up-tempo team that doesn't score a lot." Which is true.
Wow.
But you usually associate fast-paced, up-tempo teams with chances, and they make their fair share of chances, but they just can't finish them.
So would you call them? Now we're getting back into hockey talk. So would you say they're a team on the rise? Do you like the direction that you're seeing from the engineers of the Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute?
To say they're going to get better is not a very bold or noble statement, because they've got to get better.
Right.
How long will it take to get them? Pardon me. How long would it take? You guys are putting me to bed.
You got to quit drinking NyQuil before you do these.
My yawn is not an editorial statement on Rensselaer hockey. they will be better. How much better and how soon, we will have to see. But I think what they have going for them is an entire institution-wide dedication to their hockey program. They're doing a lot with funding. They're doing a lot with renovations to Houston Fieldhouse. Appert and his assistants, Sean Kurelak and Jim Montgomery, are aggressively targeting the types of players they want to play in their system. So they will get better, and they will be very good. I think they're still at least 2 years out from being a strong contender for Albany for the Pepsi, for the league championships, and probably 3 years out to be a serious contender for the NCAA tournament. I think if you give him that time, and you look at what Clarkson's done with George Roll, now they're one of the more exciting teams in the league and in the country, and have been a top 10 team basically since Christmas. You know, I think that a lot of those same traits that you see in Clarkson right now, you will see in Rensselaer in a short time. But it took George this long to get it going. You know, they were 500, and his name was mentioned in some kind of coaching watch lists. But now that they've kind of got it going and have become a prominent program, their challenge now is to sustain their prominence and make some noise in the NCAA tournament.
Exactly. And
does
I think
that answer?
Yeah,
that
it
answer
does. Well, and I think one thing you have to remember, too, with Rensselaer and Seth Appert as a coach is that now, you know, next year he'll be going into his second year. But it's with his first recruiting class. He got in late, didn't really have time to put together much of a recruiting class. So I think, you know, when you look at improvement on a year-to-year basis, I mean, you have to look at it, I think in this case, in terms of with the kids he's bringing in, and not necessarily in terms of the years that he's been there. So keep that in mind.
Oh, yeah. They're targeting defense first, and not defense, but defenseman who can make plays. He's excited about some of the commitments they have for the incoming class of 07 and the incoming class of 08 already on the line. So we'll look forward to big things from RPI.
One more thing about recruits, and just in having obviously known Seth through Denver and watching and seeing the kind of players that they've not just brought in, but the kind of guys that they've targeted early and been excited about bringing in and have turned out to be really good college hockey players. I know one guy that they were on when they were at Denver, long before anybody else was on, was Adam Buerkle. And then he got hot late in his junior career, and then all of a sudden other, you know, some other programs of higher profile started knocking on the door, and he said, no, I verbaled to Denver, and that's where I'm going. You know, they had a nice run, and then obviously when you win a couple national championships, it makes it a lot easier to lure kids in. But they had a nice run of really finding some guys that they liked early that had the attitude and the kind of mentality and demeanor that they like in a player, and going after them and getting them in. You know, we talk as much as we'll talk about the Matt Carls and the Stastnys and guys like that. You know, it's really you start with a foundation type player that has the kind of mentality and attitude that, and the talent, obviously. But you know, that's kind of how teams are built, and that's what's I would say Rensselaer fans have a lot to look forward to, just knowing kind of the kind of player and the character person that Seth Appert has been associated with in the past as far as recruits.
Was he or Killer or Guaz or somebody else the primary recruiters for Skinner and Carl? Do you remember? Do you know?
I do not remember.
All right. Thank you for not remembering.
That's a long time ago.
Yes, it is. It is. And you were Gonzo from there.
I think I was at Michigan State by then. But I'm trying to think of the guy. You know, the one guy that I really remember coming in was Connor James.
We remember him going out.
We do remember him going out. As far as coming in for a visit and kind of being the, you know, he was their must-have guy as far as like the real blue-chip guy that they wanted back in the day. And, you know, obviously things worked out pretty well.
But, he's good at hockey.
Yeah, he is good at hockey. He's had a couple sips of coffee.
I'll speak with Seth again soon and find out if he's targeting the next Skinner or Carl or a Ryan Caldwell type or Matt Latch, you know. See what kind of blue liners they're going after.
You know, it's funny. I say it's funny a lot, you know, but anyways, I mean, you bring up Ryan Caldwell. I mean, we loved him in when they made the run of the first championship. I mean, he was playing on one leg, basically.
Loved his leadership, loved his guts.
Yeah, but he never complained. He just went out there and played.
Look, were you at that Frozen in Boston?
I was not. I was at the 98 Frozen in Boston. Back when I was a little guy.
You still are a little guy.
This is true.
What's that when?
You're an adolescent little guy.
Was the 98 Frozen the one where Neil Koepke tried to blow up the Fleet Center?
I think it was.
Oh.
I've only heard the recounting.
Yeah.
It's the obligatory Neil Koepke mention in the Inch podcast. What's up, Neil? Another shout-out for Neil Koepke.
Thoughts and prayers.
Can't give a shout-out to Neil without giving a shout-out to Rico.
That's right.
Shout-out to Rico Cooney.
Shout-out to Mike Wilbon.
Yes. Yes, indeed. Anything else, boys?
Yeah.
Rook, you want to make that?
I have a shout-out. Shout-out to Ron, Ron Mexico, as always.
All right. Hello, Ron. Thank you for listening. Rook, podcast shout-out?
Yeah, I just wanted to say that, I mean, it's kind of a sad note. On Tuesday, I think the sports world lost one of a very good writer and one of the nicest human beings I've ever come across in Alan Greenberg, who was the Patriots beat writer for the Hartford Current. I mean, I knew Alan somewhat personally just from covering the team the last year, and you know, he was pretty much the greatest guy in the room every single time you saw him. He was a really funny guy, real great to be around, and a nice guy all around. I mean, he's one of the few people who made a point to go out and say hi to, I mean, pretty much every single person he saw, and never a dull moment around Alan. And it's you know, there's a lot of people in Boston who are kind of saddened by the news that Alan passed away. But you know, he was a great guy, and I just wanted to make sure that, you know, he had some snot hockey related, but just wanted to make note of that.
Well, thank you, and I think that's a fitting way to end the podcast, by saluting someone who possesses a trait that we hold very dear. He's good in the room. Thank you for listening to another Inside College Hockey podcast, and please follow our postseason coverage of all the league tournaments and upcoming NCAA tournament at InsideCollegeHockey.com.